said Mrs. Enid kindly.
"No, just listening," said Wazza.
"Nuggan talks to you, does he?"
"No, Nuggan is dead, Mrs. Enid," said Wazza.
Polly took Wazza's matchstick-thin arm and said, "Excuse us a moment, Mrs. Enid." She hustled the girl behind a huge water-driven clothes mangle. It heaved and clanked as a background to their conversation.
"Wazza, this is getting—"
Polly's native tongue had no word for freaky, but if she had known about the word, she would have welcomed its inclusion.
"Strange. You're worrying people. You can't just go round saying that a god is dead."
"God, then. Dwindled, I think," said Wazza, her brow furrowing. "No longer with us."
"We still get the abominations."
Wazza tried to concentrate.
"No, they're not real. They're like echoes. Dead voices in an ancient cave bouncing back and forth. The words changing, making nonsense. Like flags that were used for signals, but now just flap in the wind."
Wazza's eyes went unfocused, and her voice altered, became more adult, more certain.
"And they come from no god. There is no god here now."
"So where do they come from?"
"From your fear. They come from the part that hates the other, that will not change. They come from the sum of all your pettiness and stupidity and dullness. You fear tomorrow, and you've made your fear your god. The Duchess knows this."
The mangle creaked onwards. Around Polly the boilers hissed. Water gushed in the runnels. The air was loaded with the smells of soap and damp cloth.
"I don't believe in the Duchess, either," said Polly. "That was just trickery in the woods. Anyone had looked round. It doesn't mean I believe in her."
"That doesn't matter, Polly. She believes in you."
"Really?"
Polly glanced around the steaming, dripping cave. "Is she here, then? Has she graced us with her presence?" Wazza had no concept of sarcasm. She nodded.
"Yes."
"Yes."
Polly looked behind her. "Did you just say yes?" she demanded.
"Yes," said Wazza.
"Yes."
Polly relaxed.
"Oh, it's an echo. This is a cave, after all.
Which doesn't explain why my voice doesn't come bouncing back.
"Was, I mean Alice," she said thoughtfully.
"Yes, Polly," said Wazza.
"I think it would be a really good idea if you don't talk too much about this to the others," she said. "People don't mind believing in, you know, gods and so on, but they get very nervous if you tell them they're showing up. She's not going to show up, is she?"
"The person you don't believe in,"
said Wazza, showing a flash of spirit.
"I'm not saying she doesn't exist," said Polly weakly. "I just don't believe in her, that's all."
"She's very weak," said Wazza. "I hear her crying in the night."
Polly sought for further information in the pinched-up face, hoping that in some way Wazza was making fun of her. But nothing but puzzled innocence looked back.
"Why does she cry?" she said. "The prayers, they hurt her."
Polly spun around when something touched her shoulder. It was Tonka.
"Mrs. Enid says we're to get to work," she says. "She says the guards come around and check."
It was women's work, and therefore monotonous, back-breaking, and social. It has been a long time since Polly had got her hands in a washtub, and the ones here were long wooden troughs, where 20 women could work at once. Arms on either side of her, squeezed and pummeled, wrung out garments and slapped them into the rinsing trough behind them. Polly joined in, and listened to the buzz of conversation around her. It was gossip, but bits of information floated in it like bubbles in the washtub. A couple of guards had taken liberties, that is, more than had already been taken, and had apparently been flogged for it. This caused much comment along the tub. Apparently, some big milord from Ankh-Morpork was in charge of things and had ordered it. He was some kind of wizard, said the woman opposite. They said he could see things happening everywhere and lived on raw meat. They said he had secret eyes. Of course, everyone knew that city was the home of abominations. Polly, industriously rubbing a shirt on a washboard, thought about this, and thought about a lowland buzzard in this upland country, and some creature so fast and stealthy that it was only a suggestion of shadow. She took a spell on the copper boilers, ramming the stewing garments onto the bubbling surface, and noted that in this place, without weapons of any sort, she was using a heavy stick about 3 feet long. She enjoyed the work in a dumb kind of way. Her muscles did all the necessary thinking, leaving her brain free. No one knew for sure that the Duchess was dead. It more or less didn't matter. But Polly was sure of one thing. The Duchess had been a woman. Just a woman, not a goddess. Oh, people prayed to her in the hope that their pleas would be gift-wrapped and sent on to Nuggan, but that gave her no right to mess with the heads of people like Wazza, who had enough trouble as it was. Gods could do miracles. Duchesses posed for pictures. Out of the corner of her eye, Polly saw a line of women taking large baskets from a platform at the end of the room and stepping out through another doorway. She dragged Igorina away from the wash trough and told her to join them.
"And notice everything," she added.
"Yes, Corp," said Igorina.
"Because I know one thing," said Polly, waving at the piles of damp linen, "and it's that this lot will need the breeze."
She went back to work, occasionally joining in the chatter for the look of the thing. It wasn't hard. The washerwomen kept away from some subjects, particularly ones like husbands and sons, but Polly picked up clues here and there. Some were in the keep, some were probably dead. Some were out there, somewhere. Some of the old women wore the Motherhood Medal, awarded to women whose sons had died for Borogravia. The bastard metal was corroding in the damp atmosphere, and Polly wondered if the medals had arrived in a letter from the Duchess, with her signature printed on the bottom, and the son's name squeezed up tight to fit the space. "We honour and congratulate you, Mrs. L. Lapchick of Well Lane, Munns, on the death of your son, Otto Pyrohan Lapchick, on June 25 at blank." The place was always censored in case it brought aid and comfort to the enemy. It astonished Polly to find that the cheap medals and thoughtless words did, in a way, bring aid and comfort to the mothers. Those in Munns who'd received them wore them with a sort of fierce, indignant pride. She wasn't sure she trusted Mrs. Enid very much. She had a son and a husband up in the cells, and she'd had a chance to size up Blouse. She'd be asking herself, what's more likely, he gets them all out and keeps them safe, or that there's going to be an almighty mess that might well harm us all? And Polly couldn't blame her if she went with the evidence. She was aware of someone talking to her. "Hmm?" she said.
"Look at this, will you?" said Shufti, waving a sodden pair of men's long pants at her. "They keep putting the colours in with the whites."
"Well, so what? These are enemy long johns," said Polly.
"Yes, but there's such a thing as doing it properly. Look! They're putting this red pair and all the others are going pink."
"And I used to love pink when I was about 7. It is an established fact that despite everything society can do, girls of 7 are magnetically attracted to the colour pink.
"But pale pink? On a man?"
Polly looked at the next tub for a moment and patted Shufti on the shoulder.
"Yes, it is very pale, isn't it? You'd better find a couple more red items," she said. "But that'll make it even worse," Shufti began. "That was an order, soldier," Polly whispered in her ear. "And add some starch."
"How much?"
"All you can find."
Igorina returned. Igorina had good eyes. Polly wondered if they've ever belonged to someone else. She gave Polly a wink and held up a thumb. It was, to Polly's relief, one of her own. In the huge ironing room, only one person was working at the long boards when Polly, taking advantage of the temporary absence of Mrs. Enid, hurried in. It was Daphne. All the rest of the women were gathered around as if they were watching a demonstration, and they were.
"The colour, you see," said Lieutenant Blouse, flourishing the big steaming charcoal-filled iron. "Then the cuffs, and finally the sleeves. Do one front half at a time. You should hang them immediately, but, and here's a useful tip, don't iron them completely dry. It's really a matter of practice, but—"
Polly stared in fascinated wonder. She'd hated ironing.
"Daphne, could I have a word?" she said during a pause.
Blouse looked up.
"Oh, Polly," he said. "Yes, of course." "It's amazing what Daphne knows about pleat lines," said a girl in awe, "and press cloths."
"I am amazed," said Polly. Blouse handed the iron to the girl.
"There you go, Dimphna," he said generously. "Remember, always iron the wrong side first, and only ever do the wrong side on dark linens. Common mistake. Coming, Polly."
Polly cooled her heels for a while outside, and one of the girls came up with a big pile of fresh-smelling ironed laundry. She saw Polly and leaned close as she went past.
"We all know he's a man," she said, "but he's having such fun, and he irons like a demon."
"You won't tell the guards?"
"What?" said the girl, grinning. "And do the ironing ourselves? Anyway, we're dying to find out what happens when Daphne goes on her date."
"Sir, how do you know about ironing?" said Polly when they were back in the washing room.
"Had to do my own laundry back at HQ," said Blouse. "Couldn't afford a girl, and the batman was a strict nugganite, and said it was girls' work. So I thought, well, it can't be hard, otherwise we wouldn't leave it to women. They really aren't very good here. You know, they put the colours and the whites together."
"Sir, you know you said you were going to steal a gate key off a guard and break his neck," said Polly.
"Indeed."
"Do you know how to break a man's neck, sir?"
"I read a book on martial arts, Perks," said Blouse a little severely.
"But you haven't actually done it, sir?"
"Well, no. I was at HQ, and you're not allowed to practice on real people, Perks."
"You see, the person whose neck you want to break will have a weapon at that moment, and you, sir, won't," said Polly.
"I have tried out the basic principle on a rolled-up blanket," said Blouse reproachfully. "It seemed to work very well."
"Was the blanket struggling and making loud gurgling noises and kicking you in the socks, sir?"
"The socks?" said Blouse, puzzled.
"In fact, I think your other idea would be better, sir," said Polly hurriedly.
"Yes, my, other idea. Which one was that, exactly?"
"The one where we escaped from the washhouse via the clothes-drying area, sir, after silently disabling three guards, sir. There's a kind of moving room down the corridor, sir, which gets winched all the way to the roof. Two guards go up there with the women, sir, and there's another guard up on the roof. Acting together, we'd take out each unsuspecting guard, which would be more certain than you against an armed man, with all due respect, sir, and that would leave us very well positioned to go anywhere in the keep via the rooftop, sir. Well done, sir."
There was a pause.
"Did I, go into all that detail?" said Blouse.
"Oh, no, sir. You shouldn't have to, sir. Sergeants and corporals deal with the fine detail. Officers are there to see the big picture."
"Oh, absolutely. How big was this particular picture?" said Blouse, blinking.
"Oh, very big, sir. A very big picture indeed, sir."
"Ah," said Blouse, and straightened up and assumed what he considered to be the expression of one with panoramic vision.
"Some of the ladies here used to work in the upper keep, sir, when it was ours," Polly went on quickly. "Anticipating your order, sir, I had the squad engage them in light conversation about the layout of the place, sir. Being aware of the general thrust of your strategy, sir, I think I have found a route to the dungeons." She paused. It had been good flannelling, she knew. It was almost worthy of Jackram. She'd larded it with as many sirs as she dared, and she was very proud of anticipating your order. She hadn't heard Jackram use it, but with a certain amount of care it was an excuse to do almost anything. General thrust was pretty good, too.
"Dungeons," said Blouse thoughtfully, momentarily losing sight of the big picture. "In fact, I thought I said,
yes, sir, because, sir, if we can get a lot of the lads out of the dungeons, sir, you'll be in command inside the enemy's citadel, sir."
Blouse grew another inch, and then sagged again.
"Of course, there are some very senior officers here, all of them senior to me."
"Yes, sir," said Polly,
well on the way to graduating from the Sergeant Jackram School of Outright Rupert Management.
"Perhaps we'd better try to let the enlisted men out first, sir. We don't want to expose the officers to enemy fire."
It was shameless and stupid, but now the light of battle was in Blouse's eyes. Polly decided to fan it, just in case. "Your leadership has really been a great example to us, sir," she said.
"Has it?"
"Oh, yes, sir."
"No officer could have led a finer bunch of men, Perks," said Blouse.
"Probably they have, sir," said Polly.
"And what man could dare hope for such an opportunity, eh?" said Blouse. "Our names will go down in the history books. Well, mine will, obviously, and I shall jolly well see to it that you chaps get a mention, too. And who knows? Perhaps I may win the highest accolade that a gallant officer may obtain."
"What's that, sir?"
said Polly dutifully. "Having either a foodstuff or an item of clothing named after one," said Blouse, his face radiant. "General Frock got both, of course. The frock coat and beef frock. Of course, I could never aspire that high," he looked down bashfully. "But I have to say, Perks, that I have devised several recipes just in case."
"So we'll be eating a Blouse one day, sir," said Polly. She was watching the baskets being stacked.
"Possibly, possibly, if I may dare hope," said Blouse. My favourite is a sort of a pastry ring, do you see, soaked in rum."
"That's a rumbaba, sir," said Polly absently.
Tonker and the others were watching the stacked baskets too.
"It's been done?"
"Afraid so, sir."
"How about a dish of liver and onions?"
"It's called liver and onions, sir, sorry," said Polly, trying not to lose concentration.
Well, it has struck me that some dishes are named after people when really they just made a little change to a basic recipe."
"We must go now, sir. Now or never, sir."
"What? Oh, right. Yes, we must go."
It was a military manoeuvre hitherto unrecorded. The squad, coming from different directions on Polly's signal, arrived at the baskets just ahead of the women who'd proposed to take them up, grabbed the handles and advanced. Only then did Polly realise that probably no one else wanted the job and were only too happy to let idiot newcomers take the strain. The baskets were big and the wet washing was heavy. Wazza and Igorina could barely lift one basket between them. A couple of soldiers were waiting by the door. They looked bored and paid little attention. It was a long walk to the elevator. Polly hadn't been able to picture it when it had been described. You had to see it. It really was just a big open box of heavy timbers attached to a thick rope, which ran up and down in a sort of chimney in the rock. When they were aboard, one of the soldiers hauled on a much thinner rope that disappeared up into the darkness. The other one lit a couple of candles, whose only apparent role was to make the darkness more gloomy.
"No fainting now, girls," he said.
His mates chuckled.
"Two of them and seven of us," Polly thought.
The copper stick banged against her leg as she moved. All the girls carried one somewhere, and she knew for a fact that Tonka was limping because she had strapped a washing dolly under her dress. That was for serious washerwomen. It was a long stick with what looked like a three-legged milking stool on the end of it, the better for agitating clothes in a big cauldron of boiling water. You could probably smash a skull with it. The stone walls dropped past as the platform rose.
"How thrilling," trilled Daphne. "And this goes all the way up through your big castle, does it?"
"Oh, no, miss. Gotta go up through the rock first, miss. Lots of old workings and everything before we get that high."
"Oh, I thought we were in the castle already."
Blouse gave Polly a worried look.
"No, miss. There's just the wash house down here, 'cause of the water. Ah, it's a climb and a half even to the lower cellars. Lucky for you, there's this elevator, eh?"
"Wonderful, sergeant," said Blouse, and allowed Daphne back. "How does it work?"
"It's corporal, miss," said the string puller, touching his forelock. "It's pulled up and down by prisoners in a treadmill, miss."
"Oh, how horrid."
"Oh, no, miss, it's quite humane. If you're free after work, I could take you up and show you the mechanism."
"That would be lovely, sergeant."
Polly put her hand over her eyes. Daphne was a disgrace to womanhood. The elevator rumbled upwards quite slowly. Mostly they passed raw rock, but sometimes there were ancient gratings or areas of masonry, suggestive of tunnels long ago blocked. There was a jerk, and the platform stopped moving. One of the soldiers swore under his breath, but the corporal said,
"Don't be afraid, ladies, this often happens."
"Why should we be afraid?" said Polly.
"Well, because we are hanging by a rope 100 feet up the shaft, and the lifting machinery's thrown a cog."
"Again?" said the other soldier. "Nothing works properly here."
"Sounds like a good reason to me," said Igorina.
"How long will it take to repair?" said Tonka.
Last time it happened we were stuck for an hour."
Too long, Polly thought. Too many things could happen. She looked up through the beams in the roof. The square of daylight was a long way up.
"We can't wait," she said. "Oh, dear, who will save us?"
Blouse quavered.
"We'll have to find a way to pass the time, eh?" said one of the guards.
Polly sighed.
That was one of those phrases like, well, looky what we have here, that meant things were only going to get a lot worse.
"We know how it is, ladies," the guard went on. "Your men folk away and all. It's as bad for us, too. I can't remember when I last kissed my wife."
"And I can't remember when I last kissed his wife, either," said the other guard.
Tonka jumped up, caught a beam, and chinned herself on the top of the box. The elevator shook, and somewhere a piece of rock dislodged and crashed down the shaft.
"Hey, you can't do that," said the corporal.
"Where does it say?"
said Tonka.
"Polly, there's one of those filled-in tunnels here, only most of the stones have been knocked out. We could get in easily."
"You can't get out. We'll get into trouble," said the corporal.
Polly pulled his sword out of his scabbard. The space was too crowded to do much with it except threaten, but she had it, not him. It made a huge difference.
"You're already in trouble," she said. "Please don't force me to make it worse. Let's get out of here. Is that okay, Daphne?"
Yes, of course," said Blouse.
The other guard laid a hand on his own sword.
"Okay, girls, this has gone,"
he began, and then slumped. Shufti lowered her copper stick.
"I hope I didn't hit him too hard," she said.
"Who cares? Come on, I can give you all a hand up," said Tonka.
"Igorina, could you have a look at him?"
And Shufti began nervously.
"He's a man and he's groaning," said Tonka from above. "That's good enough for me. Come on."
The lone guard watched as the others were woman-handled onto the beams.
Excuse me,"
he said to Polly as she helped Blouse up.
"Yes, what?"
"Would you mind giving me a wallop on the back of the head?" he said, looking wretched, "so that it doesn't look like I didn't put up a fight against a bunch of women?"
"Why don't you put up a fight?" said Polly, narrowing her eyes. "We're only a bunch of women."
"I'm not crazy," said the guard.
"Here, let me," said Igorina, producing her stick. "Blows to the head are potentially harmful and should not be undertaken lightly. Turn around, sir. Remove your helmet, please. Would 20 minutes unconsciousness be okay?"
"Yes, thanks very much."
The guard folded up.
"I really hope I didn't hurt the other one," moaned Shufti from above.
"He's swearing," said Polly, removing the sword. "That sounds like he's okay."
She handed up the candles and then was hauled onto the trembling roof of the elevator. When she had a firm footing in the mouth of the tunnel, she found a sliver of stone and stamped it hard into the space between the shaft wall and the wooden frame, which shook. It wasn't going anywhere for a while. Tonka and Lofty were already investigating the tunnel. By candlelight, it looked like good masonry beyond the clumsy attempt at walling it up.
"It must be cellars," said Tonka. "I reckon they must have made the shaft not long ago and just walled up where it cut through. Could have done a better job, too."
"Cellars are close to dungeons," said Polly. "Now, pinch out one candle, because that way we'll have a light for twice as long, and then—"
"Perks, a word, please," said Blouse. "Over here."
"Yes, sir."
When they were standing a little apart from the rest of the squad, Blouse lowered his voice and said,
"I don't wish to discourage initiative, Perks, but what are you doing?"
"Anticipating your orders, sir."
"Anticipating them?"
"Yes, sir."
"Ah, right. This is still small picture stuff, is it?"
"Exactly, sir."
"Then my orders, Perks, are to proceed with speed and caution to release the prisoners."
"Well done, sir. We'll go through this
crypt,"
said Igorina, looking around. The candle blew out. Somewhere ahead of them, in darkness absolute and velvet thick, stone moved on stone.
"I wonder why this passage was sealed up," said the voice of Blouse.
"I think I've stopped wondering why it was sealed up in such a hurry," said Tonka.
"I wonder who tried to open it," said Polly.
There was a crash of, as it might be, a heavy slab falling off an ornate tomb. It could have been half a dozen other things, but somehow that was the image that sprang to mind. The dead air moved a little.
"I don't want to worry anyone," said Shufti, "but I can hear the sound of sort of feet, sort of dragging."
Polly remembered the man lighting the candles. He'd dropped the bundle of matches into the brass saucer of the candlestick, hadn't he? Moving her hand slowly, she groped for them.
"If you didn't want to worry anyone," came the voice of Tonka from the dry, thick darkness, "why the hell did you just tell us that?"
Polly's fingers found a sliver of wood. She raised it to her nose and sniffed the sulphurous smell.
"I've got one match,"
she said. "I'm going to strike a light. Everyone try to see a way out. Ready?"
She sidled to the invisible wall. Then she scratched the match down the stone, and yellow light filled the crypt. Someone whimpered. Polly stared, hypnotized. The match went out.
"Okay," said the subdued voice of Tonka. "Walking dead people, so?"
"The one near the archway was the late General Pullover," said Blouse. "I have his book on the art of defence."
"Best not to ask him to autograph it, sir," said Polly as the squad bunched together. There was the whimpering again. It seemed to come from where Polly remembered Wazza standing. She heard her praying. There were no words that she could make out, just a fierce and urgent whispering.
"Maybe these washing sticks can slow them down a bit," Shufti quavered.
"More than being dead already," said Igorina.
"No,"
a voice whispered, and light filled the crypt. It was barely brighter than a glowworm, but a single photon can do a lot of work in chthonic darkness. It rose above the kneeling Wazza until it was woman height, because it was a woman. Or at least it was the shadow of a woman. No, Polly saw, it was the light of a woman. A moving web of lines and highlights, in which there came and went, like pictures in a fire, a female shape.
"Soldiers of Borogravia, attention," said Wazza.
And underneath her reedy little tone was a shadow voice, a whisper that filled and refilled the long rooms.
"Soldiers of Borogravia, attention! Soldiers! Soldiers, attention! Soldiers of Borogravia!"
The lurching figures stopped. They hesitated. They shuffled backwards. With a certain amount of clattering and tongueless bickering, they formed two lines. Wazza stood up.
"Follow me," she said.
"Follow me! Me!"
"Sir," said Polly to Blouse.
"I think we go, don't you?"
said the lieutenant, who seemed oblivious of Wazza's activities, now that he was in the presence of the military might of the centuries.
"Oh, God, there's Major Galosh! And Major General the Lord Canapé! General Anorak! I've read everything he wrote. I never thought I'd see him in the flesh."
"Partly flesh, sir," said Polly, dragging him forward.
"Every great commander of the last 500 years was buried here, Perks."
"I'm very pleased for you, sir. If we could just move a little faster."
"It is my fondest hope that I'll spend the rest of eternity here, you know."
"Wonderful, sir, but not starting today. Can we catch up with the rest of them, sir?" As they passed, hand after ragged hand was raised in jerky salute. Staring eyes gleamed in hollow faces. The strange light glistened on dusty braid and stained, faded cloth. And there was a noise, harsher than the whispering, deep and guttural. It sounded like the creaking of distant doors, but individual voices rose and fell as the squad passed the dead figures.
"Death to Slovenia! Get them! Remember! Give them hell! Vengeance! Remember! They're not human! Avenge us! Revenge!"
Up ahead, Wazza had reached some high wooden doors. They swung open at her touch. Polly hurried after her. The lights travelled with her, and the squad were on her heels. To be too far behind was to be in the dark.
"Couldn't I just ask, Major General—"
Blouse began, dragging on Polly's hand.
"No, you can't. Don't dawdle. Come on," Polly commanded.
They reached the doors, which Tonka and Igorina slammed behind them. Polly leaned against the wall.
"I think that was the most amazing moment of my life," said Blouse as the boom died away.
"I think this is mine," said Polly, fighting for breath. Light still glowed around Wazza, who turned to face the squad with an expression of beatific pleasure.
"You must speak to the High Command," she said.
"You must speak to the High Command," whispered the walls.
"Be kind to this child.
Be kind to this child. This child."
Polly caught Wazza before she hit the ground.
"What's happening with her?" said Tonka.
"I think the Duchess really is speaking through her," said Polly. Wazza was unconscious, only the white of her eyes showing. Polly laid the girl down gently.
"Oh, come on! The Duchess is just a painting! She's dead!"
Sometimes you give in. For Polly, that time had been the length of time it took to walk through the crypt. If you don't believe, or want to believe, or if you don't simply hope that there's something worth believing in,
why turn round? And if you don't believe, who are you trusting to lead you out of the grip of dead men?
Dead, she said. So what? What about the old soldiers back there who haven't faded away? What about the light? And you heard how Wazza's voice sounded?
Yeah, but, well, that sort of thing doesn't happen to people you know, said Tonka.
It happens to, well, strange religious people. I mean, a few days ago she was learning how to fart loudly.
She? Whispered Blouse to Polly. She? Why is...
Once again, a part of Polly's mind overtook the sudden panic.
Sorry, Daphne, she said. Oh, yes, of course. Can't be too, yes, the lieutenant murmured.
Igorina knelt down by the girl and put a hand on her forehead.
She's on fire, she said.
She used to pray all the time back at the Grey House, said Lofty, kneeling down.
Yeah, well, there was a lot to pray about if you weren't strong, growled Tonka. And every bloody day we had to pray to the Duchess to thank Nuggan for slops you wouldn't give to a pig. And that damn picture everywhere, that fishy stare, I hate it. Could drive you mad. That's what happened to Waz, right? And now you want me to believe the old fat biddy is here and treating our friend there like some puppet or something? I don't believe it. And if it's true, it shouldn't be.
She's burning up, Magda, said Lofty quietly.
Do you know why we joined up, said Tonka, red in the face, to get away? Anything was better than what we had. I've got Lofty, and Lofty's got me, and we're sticking with you because there's nothing else for us. Everyone says the Zobinians are terrible, right? But they've never done anything to us. They've never hurt us. If they want to come over here and hang a few bastards, I could give them a list. Everywhere there's something bad happening. Everywhere the small-minded bullies are inventing new cruelties, new ways of keeping us down, that bloody face is watching. And you say it's here?
We're here, said Polly. And you are here. And we're going to do what we came to do and get out, understand? You kissed the picture. You took the shilling.
I damn well didn't kiss her face, and a shilling's the least they owe me.
Then go, shouted Polly. Desert! We won't stop you, because I'm sick of your bullshit. But you make up your mind right now, understand? Because when we meet the enemy, I don't want to think you're there to stab me in the back.
The words flew out before she could stop them, and there was no power in the world that could snatch them back. Tonka went pale, and a certain life drained out of her face like water from a funnel.
What was that you said?
The words, you heard me, lined up to spring from Polly's tongue, but she hesitated. She told herself, it doesn't have to go this way. You don't have to let a pair of socks do the talking.
Words that were stupid, she said. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it.
Tonka settled slightly.
Well, all right then, she said grudgingly. Just so long as you know we're in this for the squad, okay? Not for the army, and not for the bloody Duchess.
That was a treasonable speech, Private Holter, said Lieutenant Blouse.
Everyone but Polly had forgotten about him, and he stood there like an easy man to forget.
However, he went on, I realize we're all somewhat, he looked down at his dress, confused and bewildered by the pace of events.
Tonka tried to avoid Polly's eye.
Sorry, sir, she muttered, glowering.
I must make it clear that I will not stand to hear such things repeated, said Blouse.
No, sir.
Good, said Polly quickly. So, let's...
But I will overlook it this time, Blouse went on.
Polly could see Tonka snap, the head raised slowly.
You will overlook it, said Tonka. You will overlook it.
Careful, said Polly, just loud enough for Tonka to hear.
Let me tell you something about us, Lieutenant, said Tonka, grinning horribly.
We are here, Private, whoever we are, snapped Polly. Now let's find the cells.
Said Igorina, we're quite close, I think. I can see a sign. It's at the end of this passage. Just behind those rather puzzled armed men with the, efficient-looking crossbows. I think what you've just been saying was important and needed to be said, only, not just now, perhaps, and not so loudly.
Only two guards were watching them now, raising their bows cautiously. The other was running away down the passage, shouting. The squad, as one man, or woman, shared the thoughts.
They've got bows, we haven't. They've got a lot more swords. They've got reinforcements behind them. All we've got is a darkness full of the restless dead. We haven't even got a prayer any more. Nevertheless, Blouse made an effort. In the tones of Daphne, he shrilled, "Oh, officers, we seem to have got lost on the way to the ladies' room." They were not put into a dungeon, although they were marched past plenty. There were lots of bleak stone corridors, lots of heavy doors with bars and lots of bolts, and lots of armed men whose job, presumably, only became interesting if all the bolts disappeared. They were put into a kitchen. It was huge, and clearly not the kind of place where people chopped herbs and stuffed mushrooms. In a gloomy, grimy, soot-encrusted hall like this, cooks had probably catered for hundreds of hungry men. Occasionally, the door was opened and shadowy figures stared in at them. No one had said anything at any time. "They were expecting us," muttered Shufti. The members of the squad were sitting on the floor with their backs to a huge, ancient chopping block, except for Igorina, who was tending to the still unconscious Wazza. "They couldn't have got that elevator up by now," said Polly. "I wedged that stone in good and hard." "Then maybe the washerwomen gave us away," said Tonka. "I didn't like the look of that Mrs. Enid." "It doesn't matter now, does it?" said Polly. "Is that the only door?" "It's a storeroom at the other end," said Tonka. "No exit except a grill in the floor. Could we get out that way? Only diced." They stared glumly at the distant door. It had opened again, and there was some muffled conversation among the silhouettes beyond. Tonka had tried advancing on the open doorway and found men with swords suddenly occupying it. Polly turned to look at Blouse, who was slumped against the wall, staring blankly upwards. "I'd better go and tell him," she said. Tonka shrugged. Blouse opened his eyes and smiled wanly when Polly approached. "Ah, Perks," he said. "Well, we almost made it, eh?" "Sorry we let you down, sir," said Polly. "Permission to sit, sir?" "Treat the rather chilly flagstones as if they were your own," said Blouse. "And it was I who let you down, I'm afraid."
"Oh, no, sir," Polly protested.
"You were my first command," said Blouse. "Well, apart from Corporal Dreb, and he was 70 and only had one arm, poor chap." He pinched the bridge of his nose. "All I had to do was to get you to the valley, that was all. But no, I foolishly dreamed of a world where everyone would one day wear a blouse, or eat one, possibly. I should have listened to Sergeant Jackram. Oh, will I ever look my dear Emmeline in the face again?"
"I don't know, sir," said Polly.
"That was meant to be more of a rhetorical cry of despair, rather than an actual question, Perks," said Blouse.
"Sorry, sir," said Polly.
She took a deep breath, ready for the plunge into the icy depths of the truth. "Sir, you ought to know that, and I'm afraid, once they realize we aren't women, we'll be put in the big dungeons," he said. "Very big, and very dirty, I'm told, and very crowded."
"Sir, we are women, sir," said Polly.
"Yes, well done, Perks, but we don't have to pretend any more."
"You don't understand, sir. We really are women, all of us."
Blouse grinned nervously. "I think you've got a little confused, Perks. I seem to recall that the same thing happened to Wrigglesworth."
"Sir?"
"Although I have to say he was very good at choosing curtains."
"No, sir. I am a girl, and I cut my hair and pretended I was a boy and took the Duchess's shilling, sir. Take my word for it, sir, because I really don't want to have to draw you a picture. We played a trick on you, sir. Well, not a trick, really, but we, all of us, had reasons for being somewhere else, sir. Or at least not being where we were. We lied."
Blouse stared at her. "You're sure?"
"Yes, sir. I am of the female persuasion. I check every day, sir," Polly added.
"And Private Holter?"
"Yes, sir."
"And Lofty?"
"Oh, yes, sir. Both of them. Don't go there, sir."
"What about Shafty?"
"Expecting a baby, sir."
Suddenly, Blouse looked terrified. "Oh, no. Here?"
"Not for several months, sir, I believe."
"And poor little Private Goom?"
"A girl, sir. And Igor is really an Igorina, and wherever she is, Carborundum is really Jade. We're not sure about Corporal Maledict, but the rest of us definitely have pink blankets, sir."
"But you didn't act like women."
"No, sir. We acted like men, sir."
"Sorry, sir. We just wanted to find our men, or get away, or prove a point or something. Sorry it had to happen to you, sir." "You're sure about all this, are you?"
What are you expecting me to say? Polly thought. Whoops, now I come to think of it, yes, we're really men after all. She settled for saying, yes, sir.
So, you're not called Oliver, then?
It seemed to Polly that the lieutenant was having a lot of difficulty with all this. He kept asking the same basic question in different ways, in the hope of getting something other than the answers he didn't want to hear.
No, sir, I'm Polly, sir.
Oh, do you know there was a song about...
Yes, sir, said Polly firmly. Believe me, I'd rather you didn't even hum it.
Blouse stared at the far wall, eyes slightly unfocused. Oh, dear, Polly thought.
You took a terrible risk, he said distantly. A battlefield is no place for women.
This war isn't staying on battlefields. At a time like this, a pair of pants is a girl's best friend, sir.
Blouse fell silent again. Suddenly, Polly felt very sorry for him. He was a bit of a fool in that special way very clever people have of being foolish, but he wasn't a bad man. He'd been decent to the squad, and he'd cared about them. He didn't deserve this.
Sorry you have to be involved, sir, she said.
Blouse looked up. Sorry, he said, and to her amazement he was looking more cheerful than he had all day.
Good heavens, you don't have to be sorry. Do you know anything about history, Polly?
Can we stick with perks, sir? I'm still a soldier.
No, I don't know much history, sir, at least much that I trust.
Then you've never heard of the Amazon warriors of Samothrip? The most fearsome fighting force for hundreds of years? All women. Absolutely merciless in battle. They were deadly with a longbow, although, in order to get maximum draw, they had to cut off one of their, I say, you ladies haven't been cutting off your,
No, we haven't cut off any ers, sir, only hair.
Blouse looked incredibly relieved. Well, and then there's the female bodyguards of King Samuel in Hawanderland. All 7 feet tall, I understand, and deadly with a spear. Throughout Klatch, of course, there are many stories of female warriors, often fighting alongside their men. Fearsome and fearless, I believe. Men would desert rather than face females, perks. Couldn't deal with them.
Once again, Polly felt the slight unbalanced feeling of having tried to jump a hurdle that turned out not to be there. She took refuge in...
What do you think's going to happen now, sir?
I haven't a clue, perks.
What's wrong with young Goom? Some kind of religious mania?
Could be, sir, said Polly guardedly. The Duchess talks to her.
Oh, dear, said Blouse.
The door opened. A dozen soldiers filed in and spread out on either side. They wore a variety of uniforms, mostly Slovenian, but Polly recognized several as Ankh-Morpork, or whatever they called it. They were all armed and held their weapons like men who expected to use them. When they had lined up and were glaring at the squad, a smaller group of men stepped in. Again, there was a variety of uniforms, but they were a lot more expensive. These were worn by officers, high-ranking ones to judge by the expressions of disdain. The tallest of them, made taller by his high, plumed cavalry helmet, stared along his nose at the women. He had pale blue eyes, and his face suggested that he really did not want to see anything at all in this room unless it had been thoroughly cleaned first.
"Who is the officer here?" he said.
He sounded like a lawyer.
Blouse stood up and saluted. "Lieutenant Blouse, sir, 10th Infantry."
I see. The man looked at his fellow officers.
I believe we can dispense with the guard now, don't you? This matter should be handled quietly. And for heaven's sake, can't we find this man a pair of pants?
There were a few murmurs. The man nodded to the sergeant of the guard. The armed men filed out and the door shut behind them.
My name is Lord Rust, said the man. I head the Ankh-Morpork detachment here. At least, and he sniffed, the military detachment. You have been treated well. You have not been manhandled. I see there is a young lady on the floor.
She's in a swoon, sir, said Polly. The blue eyes lighted on her.
You would be, he said.
Corporal Perks, sir, said Polly. There were some barely suppressed smiles from the officers.
Ah, I believe you are the one seeking her brother, said Lord Rust.
How do you know that? Said Polly.
We are an efficient army, said Rust, and treated himself to a little smile of his own. Your brother's name is Paul?
Yes.
We shall locate him eventually, and I understand another lady was seeking her young man.
Shufti curtsied nervously.
Me, sir.
Again, we shall locate him if you give us his name. Now, please listen to me carefully. You, Miss Perks, and the rest of you,
will be taken from here tonight, entirely unharmed, and escorted back into your country as far as our patrols can take you, which, I suspect, will be quite a long way. Is that understood? You will have what you came for, won't that be nice? And you will not return here. The troll and the vampire have been captured. The same offer applies to them.
Polly was watching the officers. They looked nervous, except for one at the back. She'd thought all the guards had gone, and while this man was dressed like a guard, dressed, that is, like a badly dressed guard, he wasn't acting like one. He was leaning against the wall by the door, smoking half a cigar and grinning. He looked like a man enjoying a show.
"Very generously," Rust went on. "This offer applies to you too, Lieutenant, Blouse, wasn't it? But in your case, you would be on parole in a house in Slovenia. Very pleasant, I understand. Healthy walks in the countryside and all that sort of thing. This offer has not been extended to your superior officers here, I may add."
"So why make it to us?" Polly thought. "Are you frightened? Of a bunch of girls? And that makes no sense." Behind the officers, the man with the cigar winked at Polly. His uniform was very old-fashioned, an ancient helmet, a breastplate, some slightly rusted chainmail, and big boots. He wore it like a workman wears his overalls. Unlike the braid and brilliance in front of her, the only statement his clothes made was that he didn't intend to get hurt. It had no insignia that Polly could see, apart from a small shield hooked onto the breastplate.
"If you'll excuse me a moment," said Blouse, "I will consult with my men." "Men?" said Rust. "They're a bunch of women, man."
"But at this moment, sir," said Blouse coolly, "I would not exchange them for any 6 men you could offer me. If you gentlemen would care to wait outside." Behind the group, the badly dressed man burst into silent laughter. His sense of humour was not shared by the rest of the group, however.
"You cannot possibly consider refusing this offer," said Lord Rust.
"Nevertheless, sir," said Blouse, "we will take a few minutes. I think the ladies would prefer some privacy. One of them is expecting a child."
"What, here?"
As one man, the group drew back. "Not yet, I believe, but if you would just step outside." When the officers had retreated to the masculine safety of the corridor, the lieutenant turned to his squad.
"Well, men, for you it's a very attractive offer, I have to say."
"Not for us," said Tonka.
Lofty nodded.
"Nor me," said Shufti.
"Why not?" said Blouse. "You would get your husband."
"That might be a bit difficult," mumbled Shufti. "Anyway, what about the invasion?"
"I'm not going to be sent home like a package," said Igorina. "Anyway, that man has an objectionable bone structure."
"Well, Private Goom can't join us right now," sighed Blouse, "so that leaves you, Polly."
"Why are they doing this?" said Polly. "Why do they want us out of the way? Why aren't they just leaving us locked up? This place must be full of cells."
"Ah, perhaps they are sensible to the frailties of your sex," said Blouse,
and then fried in their stares.
"I didn't say I was," he added quickly.
"They could just kill us," said Tonka.
"Well, they could," she added.
"Why not? Who'd care? I don't think we count as prisoners of war."
"But they haven't," said Polly, "and they're not even threatening us. They're being very careful. I think they're frightened of us."
"Oh, yeah, right," said Tonka. "Maybe they think we're going to chase them and give them a big wet sloppy kiss."
"Good. Then we're agreed that we're not going to accept," said Blouse.
"Damn right. Oh, I do apologize." "We all know the words, sir," said Polly. "I suggest we see how much we frighten them, sir." The officers were waiting with unconcealed impatience, but Rust managed a brief smile when he stepped back into the kitchen.
"Well, Lieutenant," he said.
"We have given your offer due consideration, sir," said Blouse, "and our reply is, stick it up your—" He leaned down to Polly, who whispered urgently.
"Who? Oh, yes, right. Your jumper, sir. Stick it, in fact, up your jumper. Named after Colonel Henri Jumper, I believe. A useful woolen garment akin to a lightweight sweater, sir, which, if I recall correctly, was named after Regimental Sergeant Major Sweat. That, sir, is where you may stick it."
Rust received this calmly, and Polly wondered if it was because he hadn't understood it. The scruffy man, once more leaning against the wall, had understood it, though, since he was grinning.
"I see," said Rust. "And that is the answer from all of you. Then you leave us no choice. Good evening to you."
His attempt to stride out was hindered by the other officers, who had less sense of the dramatic moment.
The door slammed behind them, but not before the last man out turned very briefly and made a hand gesture. You would have missed it if you weren't watching him, but Polly was watching.
"That seemed to go well," said Blouse, turning away. "I hope we're not going to get into trouble for that," said Shufti.
"Compared to what?" said Tonka. "The last man out stuck his thumb up and winked," said Polly. "Did you notice him? He wasn't even wearing an officer's uniform."
"Probably wanted a date," said Tonka.
"In Ankh-Morpork, that means jolly good," said Blouse. "In Klatch, I think, it means I hope your donkey explodes. I spotted the man, looked like a guard sergeant to me."
"Didn't have stripes," said Polly. "Why do you want to say jolly good to us?"
"Oh, hate our donkey so much," said Shufti. "How's Wazza?"
"Sleeping," said Igorina, "I think."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, I don't think she's dead."
"You don't think she is?" said Polly.
"Yes," said Igorina. "It's like that. I wish I could keep her warmer."
"I thought you said she was burning up."
"She was. Now she's freezing cold."
Lieutenant Blouse strode over to the door, grabbed its handle, and, to the surprise of all, pulled it open. Four swords were levelled at him.
"We have a sick man here," he snapped to the astonished guards. "We need blankets and firewood. Get them now."
He slammed the door.
"It might work," he said.
"That door doesn't have a lock," said Tonka. "Useful fact, Polly."
Polly sighed. "Right now, I just want something to eat. This is a kitchen, after all. There could be food here."
"This is a kitchen," said Tonka. "There could be cleavers."
"But it is always upsetting to find that the enemy is as bright as you. There was a well, but a web of bars across the top allowed for the passage of nothing bigger than a bucket. And someone, with no sense of the narrative of adventure, had removed from the room anything with an edge and, for some reason, anything that could be eaten."
"Unless we want to dine on candles," said Shufti, pulling a bundle of them out of a creaking cupboard. "Stallow, after all. I bet old Scallet would make candle scubbo."
Polly checked the chimney, which smelled as though there had not been a fire in it for a long time. It was big and wide, but 6 feet up a heavy grill was hung with sooty cobwebs. It looked rusted and ancient, and could probably be shifted by 20 minutes' work with a crowbar, but there's never a crowbar when you want one. There were a couple of sacks of ancient, dry and dusty flour in a storeroom. It smelled bad. There was a thing with a funnel and a handle and some mysterious screws. Every long-established kitchen has one of these, and no one ever remembers why. It is generally for something that no one does any more, and even when it was done, it wasn't done with any real enthusiasm, such as celery basting, walnut shredding, or, in the worst case, edible dormouse stuffing. There were a couple of rolling pins, a lettuce strainer, some ladles, and there were forks. Lots of small forks. Polly felt let down. It was ridiculous to expect that someone imprisoning people in some ad hoc cell would leave in all the ingredients to effect an escape, but nevertheless, she felt that some universal rule had been broken. They had nothing better than a club, really. The toasting forks might prick, the lettuce strainer might pack a punch, and the rolling pins were at least a traditional female weapon, but all you could do with the thing with a funnel and a handle and the mysterious screws was baffle people. The door opened. Armed men came in to act as protection for a couple of women carrying blankets and firewood. They scurried in with their eyes cast down, deposited their burdens, and almost ran out. Polly strode over to the guard who seemed to be in charge, and he backed away. A huge keyring jingled on his belt. "You knock next time, all right?" she said. He grinned nervously.
Yeah, right, he said. "They said we weren't to talk to you."
"Really?" The jailer glanced around.
"But we reckon you're doing bloody well for girls," he said conspiratorially.
"So that means you won't shoot at us when we break out?" said Polly sweetly. The grin faded.
"Don't try it," said the jailer.
"What a big bunch of keys you have there, sir," said Tonka,
and the man's hand flew to his belt.
"You just stay in there," he said. "Things are bad enough already. You stay here."
He slammed the door. A moment later they heard something heavy being pushed up against it.
"Well, now we have a fire at least," said Blouse.
This
was from Lofty. She volunteered a word so seldom that the rest turned to look at her, and she stopped in embarrassment.
"Yes, Lofty," said Polly.
I know how to get the door open,"
muttered Lofty.
"So it stays open, I mean."
Had it been anyone else, someone would have laughed, but words from Lofty had obviously been turned over for some time before utterance.
Good, said Blouse. "Well done."
"I've been thinking about it," said Lofty.
Good.
It will work.
Just what we need, then, said Blouse, like a man trying against all the odds to keep cheerful. Lofty looked up at the big sooty beams that ran across the room.
Yes, she said.
But there'll still be guards outside, said Polly.
No, said Lofty, there won't.
There won't?
They'll have gone away.
Lofty stopped, with the air of one who said everything that needed to be said. Tonka walked over and took her arm.
We'll just have a little chat, shall we?
She said, and led the girl to the other side of the room. There was some whispered conversation. Lofty spent most of it staring at the floor, and then Tonka came back.
We will need the bags of flour from the storeroom, and the rope from the well, she said. And one of those... What are those big round things that cover dishes with a knob on?
Dish covers, said Shifty.
And a candle, Tonka went on. And a lot of barrels, and a lot of water.
And what will all this do? Said Blouse.
Make a big bang, said Tonka. Tilda knows about fire, believe me, and flour dust explodes.
When you say she knows, Polly began uncertainly.
I mean every place she worked at burned down, said Tonka.
They rolled the empty barrels to the middle of the room and filled them with water from the pump. Under Lofty's monosyllabic direction, using the rope from the well, they hauled three leaking, dusty flour sacks up as high as possible, so that they twisted gently over the space between the barrels and the door.
Ah, said Polly, standing back. I think I understand. A flour mill on the other side of town blew up 2 years ago.
Yes, said Tonka. That was Tilda.
What?
They'd been beating her. And worse. And the thing about Tilda is, she just watches and thinks, and somewhere in there it all comes together. Then it goes bang.
But two people died.
The man and his wife, yes. But I heard that other girls sent there never came back at all. Shall I tell you that Tilda was pregnant when they brought her back to the grey house after the fire? She had it, and they took it away, and we don't know what happened to it. And then she got beaten again because she was an abomination unto Nuggan. Does that make you feel better? Said Tonka, tying the rope to a table leg. There's just us, Polly, just her and me. No inheritance, no nice home to go back to, no relatives that we know of. The grey house breaks us all somehow. Wazza talks to the Duchess, I don't have middle gears, and Tilda frightens me when she gets her hands on a box of matches. You should see her face then, though. It lights up.
Of course, Tonka smiled in her dangerous way, so do other things.
Better get everyone into the storeroom while we light the candle.
Shouldn't Tilda do that?
She will, but we'll have to be ready to drag her away, otherwise she'll stay and watch.
This had started like a game. She hadn't thought of it like a game, but it was a game called Let Polly Keep the Duchess. And now it didn't matter. She'd made all kinds of plans, but she was beyond plans now. They'd done bloody well for girls.
A last barrel of water had been placed, after some discussion, in front of the storeroom door. Polly looked over the top at Blouse and the rest of the squad.
"Okay, everybody, we're about to do it," she said. "Are we sure about this, Tonka?"
"Yep."
"And we won't get hurt?"
Tonka sighed. "The dusty flour will explode, that's simple. The blast coming this way will hit the barrels full of water, which will probably last just long enough to see it rebound. The worst that should happen to us is that we get wet. That's what Tilda thinks. Would you argue? And in the other direction, there's only the door."
"How does she work this out?"
"She doesn't. She just sees how it should go."
Tonka handed Blouse the end of a rope.
"This goes over the beam and down to the dish lid. Can you hold it, Lieutenant? But don't pull it until we say. And I really mean that. Come on, Polly."
In the space between the barrels and the door, Lofty was lighting a candle. She did it slowly, as if it was a sacrament or some ancient ceremony, every part of which held enormous and complex meaning. She lit a match and held it carefully until the flame caught. She waved it back and forth on the base of the candle, which she thrust firmly onto the flagstones so that the hot wax stuck it into position. Then she applied the match to the candle wick. Polly and Tonka watched her kneel there, staring at the dancing flame.
"Okay," said Tonka. "I'm just going to pick her up, and you just carefully lower the lid over the candle. Right? Come on, Tilda."
She raised the girl carefully to her feet, whispering to her all the time, and then nodded to Polly, who lowered the lid with a carefulness that amounted to reverence. Lofty walked as though asleep.
Tonka stopped by the leg of a heavy kitchen table, to which she'd attached the other end of the rope holding the flour bags.
"Okay so far," she said. "Now, when I pull the knot, we each grab an arm and we run, Polly, understand? We run. Ready? Got her?"
She hauled on the rope.
"Run!"
The flour sacks dropped, streaming white dust as they fell, and exploded in front of the door. Flour rose like a fog. They raced for the storeroom and fell in a heap past the barrel as Tonka screamed, "Okay, Lieutenant!" Blouse pulled the rope that raised the lid and let the candle flame reach. The word was not woomph. The experience was woomph. It had a quality that overwhelmed every sense. It shook the world like a sheet, painted it white, and then, surprisingly, filled it with the smell of toast. Then it was over, in a second, leaving nothing but distant screams and the rumble of collapsing masonry. Polly uncurled and looked up into Blouse's face.
"I think we grab things and run now, sir," she said,
"and screaming would help."
"I think I can manage the screaming," muttered Shifty. "This is not a very nurturing experience."
Blouse gripped his ladle. "I hope this isn't going to be our famous last stand," he said.
"In fact, sir," said Polly, "I think it's going to be our first."
"Permission to yell in a blood-curdling way, sir?"
"Permission granted, Perks."
The floor was awash with water and bits, quite small bits, of barrel. Half the chimney had collapsed into the fireplace, and the soot was blazing fiercely. Polly wondered if, down in the valley, it had looked like a signal. The door was gone, so was a lot of wall around it. Beyond, smoke and dust filled the air. In it men lay groaning or picked their way aimlessly across the rubble. When the squad arrived, they did not simply fail to put up a fight. They failed to understand. Or hear. The women lowered their weapons. Polly spotted the sergeant, who was sitting and hitting the side of his head with the flat of his hand.
"Give me the keys," she demanded.
He tried to focus.
"What? The keys?
I'll have a brown one, please."
"Are you okay?"
"What?" Polly reached down and snatched the keyring from the unresisting man's belt, fighting down an instinct to apologize. She threw them to Blouse.
"Will you do the honors, sir? I think we'll be having a lot of visitors really soon."
She turned to the squad. "The rest of you, get their weapons off them."
"Some of these men are badly hurt, Polly," said Igorina, kneeling down. "There's one here with multiple."
"Multiple what?" said Polly, watching the steps.
"Just multiple. Multiple everything. But I know I can save his arm, because I've just found it over there. I think he must have been holding his sword and—"
"Just do what you can, okay?" said Polly.
"Hey, they're enemies," said Tonka, picking up a sword.
"This is an Igor thing," said Igorina, taking off her pack. "I'm sorry, you wouldn't understand."
"I'm beginning not to."
Tonka joined Polly in her watch on the stairs. Around them men groaned and stone creaked.
"I wonder how much damage we did. There's a lot of dust up there."
"There'll be a lot of people here soon," said Polly, more calmly than she felt. "Because this is going to be it," she thought. "This time there's going to be no turkey to save us. This is where I find out if I'm the meat or the metal." She could hear Blouse unlocking doors and the shouts from those within.
"Lieutenant Blouse, 10th Infantry," he was saying. "This is a rescue, broadly speaking. Sorry about the mess."
Probably his inner Daphne had added that last bit, Polly thought. And then the corridor was full of released men, and someone said,
"What are these women doing here, for God's sake? Give me that sword!"